We're back. What's happening, family? Welcome to the podcast, In the Black of My Mind. I'm your host, Al Thomas. Do me a favor and go down to the bottom of the page and click subscribe and share and tell everybody. How many bodies? Everybody's. Today's guest is a talented musician, singer, songwriter, producer, arranger, recording artist, and visionary, who's worked with folks like Case, Calvin Richardson, Philip Bailey, Jimmy Vaughn, and the group Surface. Welcome to the podcast, my brother, Robbie Jenkins. Welcome to the podcast, my brother, Robbie Jenkins. How you feeling, man?
I'm feeling great. I appreciate you having me on. I've been watching.
I appreciate you coming on, man. I appreciate you coming on, man. You know, I like to take it back before we go forward. So now I know you, and it's going to be interesting because I know you. So we know each other so well, but it's at the same time, there are things that we don't know about each other. So we'll just pretend that we don't really know each other, man.
I don't really know you.
So you're born and raised in Stamford. When did you start playing music?
Officially, I'd say when I was nine. Officially.
Nine. Mm-hmm. Okay. And your first instrument was
a cello.
Now, what made you choose cello?
Because my fingers were too big for the violin.
Oh, okay.
And at the same time, I was at a height where the cello was cumbersome for me to carry to school. But I really wanted to play the guitar. That was always my first instrument of choice, and I had cousins that played guitar and bass, you know, and every other Sunday or so we would go over to their house, and I would just sit there and just stare and listen. Then of course, you know, you watch television, you see people with guitars and they're singing and playing, and I wanted to do that. But I started to like the cello. In fact, I still use a lot of the cello in some of my arrangements, you know, especially my ballad. You'll always hear some independent cello line, especially if I'm using strings. But yeah, so the cello was first, and then guitar came like a real close second, and then I was doing both of them at the same time.
Oh, wow.
And my mother kicked me out of the house. She said, "You're in the house too much."
Okay.
Pick one instrument. So I picked the guitar with the vow that I would always go back and play the cello. So I see myself in the future being like 75, 80 and playing Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star on the cello. That's nice. Probably all I'll be able to play.
Please. Yeah,
no concertos or anything like that.
You know, did you by any chance see the episode with Howard Cloud?
I missed that one. I keep saying I'm going to go back to catch that.
Because he went back and got a degree from Berkeley.
Oh, did he?
Yeah,
oh,
he did the online thing. But yeah, he got, you know, and then went and just got his master's degree, like I guess the beginning of this past year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I was like, man, you better brother than me, man, because I know that it ain't firing the way it used to fire back in the day and stuff, man. I'm like,
you know. We know the struggle.
The struggle is real. Oh, man. Now, you said that you had other family members that played guitar and bass and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. You know, are any of them still involved? Are any of them still still with us that still play? Or?
One of them still is, Vernon Montgomery.
Oh, Vernon. Yep. Why didn't I know that Vernon was your cousin?
I don't know. You never asked me.
Okay. Yeah, because Terry played bass.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. Wow.
Yeah, and they sang. All of them sang. Right? So you, and then you had Derek, who played drums and or percussion.
Okay.
And then you had Kevin, God rest his soul, he was the youngest. And sometimes he would play percussion too, but mostly he sat next to me and watched. That was that. Yeah.
Now you came up through the school of Chuck Dudley.
Yes, I did. I was thinking
Tell
about
folks
Chuck.
about Chuck Dudley, man.
Oh, wow. So Chuck was, well, as a teacher, no nonsense. You were not going to slide past him. You didn't want to go a week without practicing, because your doom was going to really come to play and manifest itself when you sat down in front of him. It almost seemed like he could tell that you didn't practice before you even touched your instrument. It's like,
He saw fear on your face as you walked in the door.
you didn't practice this week. Right? So he had me playing like really really challenging jazz standards, Five Brothers, and the list goes on. There's so many. And you couldn't fake those. And the easiest way to catch you is these were all songs that were much older than I was. So I wasn't even familiar with them until he said, play this. Right? Sat the music in front of me. We went through it. And the next week he expected you to play it and to read it. And so he would kind of stop you sometimes, stop here, jump to this measure right here, play that measure right there.
So you can't memorize it.
Yeah, no, they don't memorize it. He could tell when you memorize too. Sometimes he let you get through the whole song, and I'm playing and smiling. Whew, last note.
Yeah, I
And then
made
he'd
it.
say, you memorize that. And I could tell because you missed that note right there. Or that one you didn't hold, it was supposed to be, three beats or whatever it was, and you cut it short. That shows you were anxious. You just wanted to get through it. Right? But after maybe 6 months, I don't know if it was that long, but after about maybe 2 or 3 months of being immature as a musician, he taught me how to be self-disciplined about, taking music seriously and really applying yourself, and why that's important. As you are an instrumentalist, you're expressing what the composer has put down on paper. And you owe it to them and to the listener to do what was transcribed for you. Your job is you're a messenger, right? So don't screw up the message, right? So that I think overall, that's the thing that I learned about him, or learned from him. And that helped a lot for everything else that came after.
Yeah, and there's so many folks that I know that study. I said, man, if you play guitar and you're any good, and you came from Stanford, Norwalk area, you study with Chuck.
Yeah, you did.
And there's so many folks that I know that came through. I think Howard started with him, if I'm not mistaken.
I think he did too.
Yeah,
I
because.
seem to recall talking to him about that, way back.
So you came up playing guitar, playing local bands and stuff.
I did.
What made you choose Berkeley?
Well, that wasn't my first choice, but it should have been. My first choice was
Oh, that's right. You
actually,
went to the University of Hartford before you went to Berkeley.
and I
Oh,
wanted to
my
go to
bad.
Howard. I wanted to go to Howard, and they actually accepted me, but they wanted me to come down and audition, which I didn't have a problem with. The problem with the date was that it was the day after my senior prom. And being the first African American senior class president in the history of my high school, I was not going to miss the prom, and I wasn't going to get up at the crack of dawn and try to catch a train to Washington, D.C. in order to be on time for a 10 a.m. audition. So I enjoyed my prom, and I sent Howard in a recorded audition. Now, today that wouldn't be a problem because it's digital. Back then, it was analog and it was cassette. Went through the post office, got x-rayed, and erased.
Oh, man.
And I liked that audition. It was pretty good.
Mm.
But it never got erased.
They wouldn't allow you another date?
No. Because, you know, if you think about it, you were talking the end of May, beginning of June,
mm-hmm.
right? So I think they were right at the edge of, you know, ending their whole audition process.
Gotcha.
So, so the University of Hartford was one of my other choices, and they accepted me. The issue with them initially was that they were predominantly a classical school. McLean, the late Jackie McLean, a wonderful musician and professor and all of that. He was just starting the jazz program. It wasn't officially there yet. So I took classical guitar, which was challenging because for classical guitar on your right hand, you have to grow fingernails.
Right.
For the plucking. And right. for your left hand, you don't need fingernails, you know, because mm-hmm. you're on the fretboard. The issue was not that. The issue was that you were all music students were required to take piano.
Mm.
And my nails are not the strongest. So I grow them, be happy and get the nice tone and then practice piano. And there'd be a fingernail laying right there.
Mm.
So that was a constant thing. My teacher's name, and I just remembered it in this moment, Alan Spriestersbach, who was very patient with me. And at the same time, he wasn't.
Mm.
Because he could see I knew the fingering and I could read and all of that. But he's really interested in the whole package, like your tone. And because there's a lot of different technique, you know, to play your volume a certain way, and that's all based on how you finger.
Right.
But he couldn't tell if I had mastered that part because I never really had solid fingernails for long.
Mm.
So we'd have these bursts of amazement and then nothing. It sounded good. Snap. Oh.
Dang.
Yeah. Sorry, Alan.
Now, don't they have clips or something like that you can put on your fingers?
Not allowed.
Oh, really?
Not allowed.
Wow.
Very, very traditional, very strict. You know, if you're playing classical guitar, you have to use your fingernails.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep. But I saw those. I had some of those.
Interesting. Now, I jumped ahead too far. While you were in high school, I know you did with my frat brother Jesse Chapman. You guys went. You had that great choir, and you guys you went to other countries and stuff. What was that all about?
So the West Hill Chamber Singers were members of Friendships Ambassadors, which was a youth exchange program,
mm-hmm.
and they were members since the beginning of the choir, which I believe dates back to 73 or 74.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been to Romania. They've been everywhere. China. My senior year, they were planning to go to Egypt and India.
Mm.
And so here's the thing about me even being in the choir, you know, in the school system here, they have what's called a feeder system. So if you were involved in the music program in middle school, your middle school teacher would talk to the high school teacher that you were going to, whatever school you're going to.
Mm-hmm.
And usually the high school teacher would call and say, who you got? Who's coming up here? And so my name was mentioned. And then he was looking for me, literally. When I came in the door, he was like, it was kind of creepy, actually. But he was standing. I don't know anybody other than people I got on the school bus with.
Right, right.
And there's this guy standing there in the lobby. You're Robbie Jenkins? Yes. My name is Mr. Chapman. I'm the music, you know, director, the chair for the music department here. And I understand that you have a very nice singing voice, and I would like you to join the choir. I said, okay, I'll think about it. We go into the freshman orientation, the West Hill Chamber Singers, because they're singing Baroque music and chamber music and such. And they got laughed at. by all the freshmen. Yeah, Luther was actually singing in there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, and it's really because they're immature and we don't know what that is. We never heard it before. And it's like, oh, okay, they're singing these vowel sounds. And what's that? You know, and I'm looking around, I was like, I'm not doing that.
Yeah, none for me, thanks.
None for me.
Yeah,
so, so he asked me every year of high school. My junior year, right before we were ending the school year, he approached me again. And he said, so you think you will go out for the choir this year? I said, no. What a shame. We're going to Egypt, India, and London. When are the auditions again? So I auditioned. They let me in. We actually, that summer, between junior and senior year, we went up to the University of New Hampshire. There was a gentleman there. I want to say his last name was Howard, Dr. Howard. And forgive me if I'm wrong, but he was an authority on Negro spirituals. And our choir was predominantly Caucasian, and they weren't tremendously familiar with that. So he really wanted to just get us all, you know, whipped into shape. And he did. We were there for about a week. And then once we came back, it was just a lot of fundraisers and rehearsals. And we went. There was one thing about that trip, and aside from being able to travel at such a young age, which was a blessing in itself, but the event that happened on that trip really was pivotal in terms of my direction and being really confirming that that's what I wanted to do professionally. During one of our rehearsals before we left, I had written this song for this girl. You already know this story. I wrote a song for a girl who was in the choir who I thought I was in love with. And I wrote this song, and it's called Till I Met You. And I wrote the song, and I'm playing it for her. At first, I played it for her on the piano when just she and I in the music room, and she's crying. And I said, oh, I should stop. I think I should stop. This must really suck. And then, so... So as soon as I finished, I apologized. I'm sorry. She said, no, it's good. I'm just so happy. And I'm sad. Well, why are you sad? I won't say the other guy's name. I just started dating a couple of days ago.
Wow.
I just didn't write the song fast enough.
Is it?
Mr. Chapman heard me. During rehearsals, during breaks, sometimes I would just sing the song, just jump on the piano and play and sing. And some choir members, four of them, made up their own background parts. And we went through the whole song. And then when it was done, I hear this voice behind me. Is that your song? And I look back. It's Mr. Chapman. And I said, yes. He says, you'll be performing that during our tour.
Wow.
Right.
Okay.
So, but the significance of all that is that we performed, and it wasn't every single performance. He would just kind of give me a gesture, of, you know, to come down out of the choir loft. And we were at the American School in Cairo, Egypt. So that was a school for American students whose parents had relocated there, transferred there because they worked for a business. Maybe they worked for this gas company. I won't say any brand names here, and so this is where their kids went, and it was K through 12. So they set it up for us to perform for the high school students, and they didn't have an auditorium, so it was in their gym. And one side of the gym, they had all the bleachers out for them, and we had a section of bleachers across the way just for a choir stand. And I had a fro then.
Okay.
And so
that was the time. Man.
That was the time. Yeah. And so he gestured for me to come down. As soon as I started walking down, all these screams, which was I almost laughed. But anyway, I went down. I never heard what he said that day as far as an introduction for the song. But in any case, I sat down and I played the first three chords and they screamed. And then I sang the first three words and they screamed. And they screamed through everything. Wow. And I'm looking at now, so the background singers are to my right and the audience is to my left. And so every once in a while, I'd look at them and just kind of laugh through some of it because I said, they can't hear what I'm doing anyway because they're screaming, right? But then when it was, when the song was just about over, the refrain that, you know, it's repeated at the end, they were singing it, the background singers, and they went from smiling to fear and backing away and stepping back up into the stand. And then when I looked, all the adults had come together and formed like a human chain because they emptied the bleachers and ran towards me.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, oh, wow. But, so first of all, in that moment, I decided, okay, this, I really want to do this. And it wasn't just because of their physical reaction trying to get to me for whatever reason that was going to be, but really because a song that I had written on the other side of the globe in my bedroom for a girl who's 30 feet away from me, who likes the guy standing two rows behind her.
Right.
Touch them in some way, touch them in some way. Right. And so I figured if I have that song, maybe there's some more, or maybe I could possibly write some more. That's when I made the commitment.
Was that the first song you ever wrote?
No, the first song I ever wrote was called Mother Dear for Guess Who?
Okay.
My mother.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was my first song.
Okay.
It only had three chords, which was not bad.
Hey, there's a lot of there's a hits out here, man.
With one chord.
Boom, boom, boom. There ain't no chords. It's just two notes.
But yeah, that was it. That was my first song.
Hey, this is Marian Meadows, and you're listening to and watching In the Black of My Mind podcast.
Now, when it's interesting because the summer I got out of the military, I came home and then we did the play. That's when we reconnected
Burning up.
One hot summer.
Yeah.
So, now, the first time I heard you play, I was like, oh, wait a minute. This brother, he's pretty serious. He just, you know, I mean, your rhythm guitar, man, is impeccable. Because you have,
I said, maybe it was.
Oh, man. You have this way of phrasing stuff and the rhythms that you play, man. It was just, it was just really beautiful, man. So I was like, oh no, this brother can play, man. You know,
Thank you.
All right, I knew you played guitar, and then it's like, oh, and I play piano too. Oh, you do you? So, you know, I'm like, all right, this dude just graduated high school. So he's doing all this stuff already. All right. So I'm impressed. And so then you know, we put the band together. And we have horns, and you're writing horn parts. We got a violin player, and you're writing violin parts. And I'm like, where did this come from? How did you? Because you just graduated high school, hadn't yet gone to college yet, and you're already orchestrating and stuff. I'm like, how'd you do? Where'd that come from? Where'd you learn how to put this together?
So when I was in seventh grade, I had a friend of mine who I just reconnected with on Facebook. I found him. Cecil Daniels. Shout out to Cecil. Cecil played trombone. And at that time in at Clunan, our Clunan Middle School, I played guitar in the jazz band. And that was pretty much it. And I didn't really talk much or sing. Nobody knew I sang, not even me. And then so on Saturdays, Cecil would walk from Clunan Middle School up North Street past the hospital to Merrill Avenue with the trombone to come to my living room, and I'm on the guitar with an amplifier. And then we would invite this kid, Richie Addison, shout out to him, wherever he is, I want to find him. He played flute, and he was only in the fourth grade. We had Richie coming down from the fifth floor, Cecil coming up from North Street, and me, and we're in my living room, and they're playing these little parts I wrote out, right? And my mother's in the kitchen surviving this. She never told us to stop. She never told us to turn anything down. She never kicked us out. just from that alone, because I can kind of hear some of that stuff in my head now, she's a saint. I think second to Mother Teresa. because this just wasn't one Saturday. This was every Saturday. During the week, I was really experimenting with different sounds and combinations and, you know, just different things, just out of curiosity, really. Mm-hmm. And once I started working with Chuck a few years later, because by then I'd started taking guitar lessons when I was 10. Mm-hmm. But this gentleman at Connecticut Music Store, his name was Mickey Cupiola. Mick was an older gentleman, retired, but he could play. Mm-hmm. And he was another one that I had a songbook, right, from that year. It was current, had pop songs that, you know, that you knew, but then he'd pull out this sheet music from songs I'd never heard of by people I've also never heard of. Mm. And this was a way of getting you to play and know that you're not playing by ear.
Gotcha.
Because you don't know this stuff, so you have to actually learn it. It was then I started getting really curious, you know, about writing, you know, just, you know, reading certain notes and then figuring it out on the piano, and then it expanded from there. So that's where it started.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Because I'm like, you know, you're writing these violin parts. I was like, yo, man, he's writing for a violin, not just putting down something on the paper and stuff, you know.
Cecil and Rich and Richie, they were very instrumental in that, helping me to learn that, just from being gracious enough to come and work with me every weekend. And I wasn't even paying them. Mm. I didn't have any money, you know. Mm. But it wasn't like we were going to try to put something together and go perform. And actually, I did. Cecil wasn't able to join us that day, but it was another friend of mine from Merrill Avenue, Nate Wilson, who played drums, and then Richie on the flute and Robbie on the guitar. Do you remember Ken Munson?
Yeah,
Super Flute. Yeah. God rest his soul. He hired us to play out in front of the Democratic headquarters on election night.
Really?
And we played the two songs that we knew, which were songs that I wrote. Uh-huh. And they were instrumental songs, and we just played them on repeat. Mm. You know, Richie's mom was out there. My mom was there. Nate's family was out there. And that was our captive audience. He gave us a break, right? And we took a break, had some hot chocolate. And then we went out there and we played some more. I think we were there for about an hour.
Okay.
Right. And he paid us each $10. That was my first professional gig.
Oh, nice. Nice. Yeah. How did you get started professionally? I mean, I know that was we always, you know, I know that when you get paid for playing a gig, that's professional. But I mean, you know, when you took it to the next level, how did you get started?
So a friend of mine who's really like a brother, we have the same birthday, actually. His name is Jimmy Zygmunt. And Jimmy worked at Macy's one year for Christmas. He came home from college, and he had this customer that came in and bought like $300 worth of sweaters. And Jimmy recognized him and talked to him and told him about me. And so the gentleman said, well, bring him up to come see me. I'd like to meet him. Mm-hmm. And it was starting to snow, and I didn't live on Merrill Avenue at that time. I lived on Connecticut Avenue. And those who are familiar with that and live in Stanford know that that has one of the steepest hills in the city. Yeah. You don't go anywhere unless it's an emergency when it's snowing, right? If you have to go up or down that hill. And Jimmy called me from work, took a break and called me. What are you doing at 7 o'clock? I said, same thing I'm doing now. Nothing. Right. He said, well, now you are. You got to take a ride with me. I got to introduce you to somebody. So I said no. At 7 o'clock, he pulled up in front of my house. And I'm sitting there, as I call it, like white knuckling it, because I'm holding on to everything so tight as we're driving and sliding. And we made it up to Cascade Road, and he introduced me to Kashif.
Oh, okay.
And I knew that he had moved there. He moved there that summer before. Mm-hmm. He had bought the house from the Robinsons. And so we met and we talked, and he gave me an internship. a paid internship. And that went on for a while. And I was looking for a job as I was working as a long-term temp at the time. And eventually I stopped doing that. I was with him full time. And so that's where the production thing came in. Like a lot of the things that I do now, some of it are just little snippets of ideas in terms of how to record sound a certain way or mix it a certain way. That came from just me observing some of the sessions he did, you know, with Whitney and George Benson and Kenny G and Melba Moore and Dionne Warwick and Stacey Ladislaw. It's just like he had it's like a who's who of people just walking through there all the time. And as much as I, you know, introduced myself to a lot of them and had some conversations, I was more interested, with the exception of Whitney, I was more interested in just observing how they worked and observing how he worked with them, because everybody was different. Everybody's personalities are different. You kind of have to have an unofficial degree in psychology because you're dealing with people's personalities, their whims, their attitudes, how they're feeling that day. All of that is very important in terms of being able to get what you want, the performance that you want out of them. So that's where that started. And then from now, there.
Let me interrupt you for a minute. Now, was Kashif doing the mixing or did you have an engineer as well?
It depended on the day. Sometimes it was just him. He's engineering and giving instruction and doing all of that. And then sometimes he'd have an engineer, depended on scheduling and availability. He had Daryl Gustamaccio, John Harris. Those were the two main engineers that worked at the studio when I first started going up there. I'm surprised I remember everybody's names. Right. I just amazed myself. but they were really good. And they taught me a lot about engineering, especially during that time. It was analog, so it's not digital like it is now. So you had to really do a lot, you know, with busing and, you know, just working with tape and just, there's a lot. Laying down MIDI code.
And editing can definitely be interesting.
Splicing
tape.
My favorite thing never to do was punching people in. And the reason why is because people don't realize that they just think, well, just punch me in between these two words. The issue is that were you breathing during that time or not? Was it a long note that kind of spilled into the next note, or was it really a clear space? And it was hard to get people to understand it. So I developed this thing where tape doesn't lie. So you just let them hear it. Now you can hear what I was thinking about. You know, now what do you think? Because now we have to sing this whole phrase over again because you want me to punch you in. You know, it's not like now, digital, you can do all kinds of stuff.
Interesting. So after Kashif, what do you do?
So after Kashif, I was home. I went back to temping again. And I get a phone call from a childhood friend who's slightly older than me and had and was really doing some amazing things career-wise already. They were performing in Stanford at one of our theaters, and they were opening for Blue Magic. And so I went to the show, and I went home. And I called him the next day. I said, I really enjoyed the show. He said, why didn't you let me know you were there? You should have came backstage. Even to this day, I'm just not a backstage person. I just feel like I'm in the way. Right? I don't really have a purpose for being there. And sometimes people can let you know that you are in the way. Because you move over there, you know, if I have to be asked to move more than three times, I should go. So I just didn't go back there. But he says to me, how would you like to make more money than you ever made in your life? I said, well, that's an interesting question because I don't know how much money I've ever made in my life. And could you tell me? So we're laughing about that. But he offered me an opportunity to come and audition because they had just fired the keyboard player they had that night. And They didn't have a full band, so they were playing, you know, with some backing tracks, but the guy was playing keys along with them, and they were performing live, mm-hmm. The group. So I said yes, I was interested. He gave me the name, you know, three songs to learn off their current album, and I had to come down to New York the next day and play it on the keyboards. I said, okay. And I hung up and I said, I don't even have a keyboard. So I learned it on the guitar,
right?
And prayed the following day all the way on the train ride into New York for the audition that I knew the instrument well enough to be able to transfer that onto the piano. And as God would bless me with enough of his blessing, because when I tell you I didn't really know, I had no clue of whether it was going to work or not. I guess it was sufficient. It was Surface. Bernard Jackson, you know, shout out to Bernard, AB. He was the one that called me. And then it was Dave Townsend who told me well into the tour, because I was recounting for him what I just said, you know, about me being concerned. He said, that wasn't an audition. We already discussed it. We already decided you were going to play.
Oh.
So I think that was Bernard's way of just keeping you in check and making sure you didn't feel like you had nepotism going on, just, you know, because you're like a younger brother to me, that you could just walk in here and just think you got the gig. You have to earn it. Which I appreciate. I appreciate that. It just keeps you on your toes. And so I did a few tours with them, but that's when I started with Surface.
Cool.
Mm-hmm.
And you did something with Jimmy Vaughn?
Yes. That was interesting because I've heard the blues. I've, you know, listened to the blues before. But one of the things that I can't remember exactly who it was that said it in an interview, and I happened to catch it. And this is before things were going on the internet and YouTube and, you know, all that stuff. This was an actual interview, a television interview. And this person who is a musician, I remember him saying that if you want to be an active musician that makes money, then don't pigeonhole yourself into one style of music, because that's following a trend, and trends come and go.
Right.
And I won't say any, but there's plenty of styles of music that we've witnessed during the times that we were young teenagers right up until now. And we don't even listen to that stuff anymore.
And
a lot of people really just kind of locked into those genres, and that's all they would play. So when those gigs dried up, they didn't have anywhere else to go. So I listened to everything. And at that time, especially, it was nothing for me to be driving in my car and hit the scan button, and something might roll up with a Latin station, and I'm listening to, you know, soca music, or I'm listening to merengue or whatever, and then I'll hit it again, and then I hear the Red Hot Chili Peppers, or I'll hit it again, and then I'm listening to smooth jazz, you know. But of course, R&B and pop stations as well. But the whole thing is just enough to be familiar. You don't have to, you know. And I used to tell people, especially when I was teaching a little bit, I would say, look, if you don't like something, that's okay, as long as you could tell me why you don't like it.
Right.
It can't be, I just don't listen to that kind of music. Well, I don't know if you would listen to music based on the genre. Listen to music.
Music, period, right.
Period, yeah.
There's good and bad music in every genre.
In every genre, yes, there are. And so from that, with Jimmy, he was a blues artist, and he opened, actually his brother was Stevie Ray Vaughan. Stevie was B.B. King's godson.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, he later, you know, took him on as his godson.
Okay, gotcha.
And Jimmy had the Fabulous Thunderbirds when he had his own act and recorded. He had some very successful recordings. And then he went on tour opening for Etta James and B.B. King. And it was a blues tour that went for 2 months. And I watched B.B. and Etta's show every single night. And what was interesting about it is that they didn't have flash pots and fancy lighting and dancers and, you know, but every single show, I can almost calculate when it was going to happen, if they didn't stray away from the format from one night to the next, where the audience was going to respond to certain things. Mm. After about a week of seeing the shows, you just, here it comes. They scream, they applaud, right, they stand up. And I wanted to know what that was. What made them do that without, you know, BB sat on the stool, Etta sat on the stool. BB turned 70 that year. The man was touring 350 something shows days a year. Etta was just coming out of a health situation, a health crisis, and she had fought through and won. She wasn't 100% health wise, but when she sat on that stool and opened her mouth, oh man, right? So the whole thing was, what was it about them that made them so special? And what it was the authenticity of their performance, right? The you felt what they were giving you, right? And that's what audiences connect with. You know, it's not about the production as much. I mean, some people would beg to differ on that, I guess. But I think what keeps people connected is if they feel like they know you. And if you're doing a live performance and it's live, then you give some of you to them.
Right.
And if you're doing it well enough, then they feel special that they shared the same room space with you, no matter how big the room is or how small. And that's what I wanted to see. And then once I locked in and figured that out, then I enjoyed the show. I wasn't studying anymore. I was just enjoying it. And listening for little nuances or things that might've changed. Because sometimes things did change, you know, they might've dropped a song from the set, you know, maybe because they had to go shorter, you know, but it was definitely, that was the biggest part of that experience for me. And Jimmy was very easy to work with. In fact, we rehearsed in Austin, Texas for a week. That's it. And his wife, Connie, was very nice. And she invited the band over for dinner. And I did eat a lot. Somebody should do something with that person. I mean, he's going to eat us out of house and home. But yeah, it was a great experience. You know, and it just, I like working with musicians and being introduced to them, because everybody brings something to the table.
Right.
So
how'd you begin working with PM Dawn?
Oh, that was funny. That whole thing was funny. So when I was working with Surface on the second tour, my roommate was Tony Bridges. Shout out to Tony Bridges. He was the bass player. And when he left the Surface tour, he got called to do the gig with PM Dawn. And that was in December. And so then he calls me in February and he says, "Hey, look, Rob, now mind you, I was working for a medical facility and I had constant chondritis, which is a very fancy name for a term for bruised ribs. I was trying to help a very robust woman." I was trying to help her get onto the CAT scan table.
Oh, no.
And I bruised my ribs.
No.
So I had to go home. Right. So I went home. They were telling me it's the same as having a sprained ankle, except you could prop your ankle up and do anything else you want.
Right.
With bruised ribs, every time you breathe, your ribs are moving.
I was just getting ready to say,
So no singing and minimal amount of talking. It may take you a couple of days and then they'll, you know, heal up. Well, that night I get a phone call from Tony. "Hey, PM Dawn is firing all their background singers and there's one spot open for male background vocalists. The stuff is easy. You nail this. Just come down and audition tomorrow." Now, this was also the night of a blizzard. It's something about me and snow. And, I mean, the Metro North trains were freezing up. The wires were freezing up. And so I said, "Well, Tony, I don't know. You know, I told him about my medical situation." He says, "Oh, that's too bad, because first stop is London. What time and what's the address again?" So I take the train down. There's barely anybody on the train because of the weather.
Right.
I get down there. I make it over to SIR Studios on West 25th. And the person who ran the space and myself were the only two people there.
Okay.
And I like to go early anyway, just so I'm not rushing in. I get time to warm up or whatever I need to do. But we were the only ones there for about 2 hours.
Oh.
And then he says to me, he keeps walking past me. He says, I don't know if anybody's coming. I said, well, somebody better come.
Right.
Because I just came from Connecticut. Right. So then the drummer came, Todd Snare. Todd was from Queens. One of the nastiest drummers I've heard. And he comes in and he's walking around and he's calling and he says, I don't know if we're gonna have an audition today. I said, well, I don't care if you're the only one that hears me sing Mary Had a Little Lamb or whatever. Mm. Somebody's gonna hear me sing something. So he kind of laughed. Eventually everybody came.
Okay.
Well, the music director, Herbie Tribino, Nataraj, this is what we call him now, but he came. The other female vocalists that were going to audition, and I think there were one or two other male vocalists that came to audition, and we all had to learn the parts for this one song, which was Patient Eyes. That was a PM Dawn. It was a hit for them.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm listening to it. We're all listening. Then we take a break, and I sit down at the piano, and I started playing it, and so I called the guys over, and we're going over the parts. They're asking me questions and I'm helping them. And which is not typical for an audition. Usually.
Right, right. It's competitive. Yeah.
What do I know? Mr. Helpful. Right?
Yeah.
So what ends up happening is then we try different combinations. Okay, let's have that male vocalist with these singers, that kind of thing. And then when we had gotten through, now by this time, the whole band has showed up.
Mm-hmm.
And which is like 5 or so hours from the time I walked in there.
Oh, man.
So I had been there the longest than anybody, next to the guy who opened the door. And so they went around, took a vote. Which male vocalist do you like? And they pointed to me. Todd said, I like him. Mm-hmm. Right? Pointing with a drumstick. So then the girls, they had to kind of figure out which ones. And then they did. And so we're sitting there. Actually, as we're standing there, the door opens and there's some other people standing there. And I can see the looks on their faces like, those were the background singers who were not told that they were fired yet.
Oh, wow. James Brown.
They showed up for a rehearsal and saw five other people. And I recognized it right away because that happened to me when I was in high school where Tyrone Dunmore and they brought me on to be a guitar player and didn't tell, I won't say the guitarist's name.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't tell him that he was being replaced. And so now I knew whose guitar that was by the door.
Mm.
So he came in, he looked at me like, right. So in any case, I recognized that look with those other singers and they didn't say anything to us. They didn't say anything. They just stepped back. Well, one of the singers was Prince B's girlfriend.
Wow. And he didn't tell her?
The music director didn't tell her.
Wow.
So she called B. And now it's like 8 o'clock at night. And the finalists are sitting there. We're talking with Herbie and rehearsal spaces, the doors are heavy,
mm-hmm.
right? And, so they're soundproof. So if you're going into a rehearsal space, you pull this heavy door, then there's about a foot's worth of space there, and then you push the other door in. Well, while we're sitting there, the door flew open and hit the wall. Boom! The room kind of shook a little bit.
Mm.
And there stood Prince B.
Mm-hmm.
All 6'4" of them.
Mm-hmm.
And X amount of pounds and
little such,
yeah, massive sunglasses on. It's 8 o'clock at night, but he has sunglasses on. And he walks in. Herbie seemed unfazed by this.
Mm-hmm.
We were, I don't know, in shock, traumatized maybe. And he comes over to Herbie and he says, Can I see you outside for a minute? And turns around and walks back out. Herbie says, I'll be right back. He walks out. So as soon as he walks out, I turn to everybody and say, so it was really nice to meet you. Let's exchange numbers now so right. we can stay in contact. If you hear of any gigs, you call me, I'll call you, and I'll call you too. We exchange numbers.
Wow.
Then Herbie comes back in, and he stands there, and B comes behind him, and as he walks past him, he says, and they better be good too, and walks down to the other end and stands near a speaker. So we sang what we had learned, and I'm watching him out of the corner of my eye to see if he's feeling anything, and his head's moving a little bit. Mm-hmm. That didn't mean anything. He could have been just listening to his own tracks and saying, I like what I did there.
Right, right.
But in any case, he walked back past Herbie. Can I see you outside for a minute? And they walked out, and then Herbie said, okay, you're hired again. Oh, I didn't realize we had been fired. We had been fired? Oh, okay. All right. So I went to work the next day and I get a phone call from the tour manager. I'm thinking he's going to give me a rehearsal schedule. And he says, I need you to please consider doing us a favor. The guys have asked if you would be willing to come back and audition again. I was hired.
Then
I was fired. Then right. I got hired again.
Right.
Somewhere between last night, my train ride home, and going to bed ecstatic and coming to work today, did I get fired again? He says, no. What it was is the original male vocalist. This was his, first of all, his mom was very close friends with B and Jarrett's mom. They went to church together.
Uh-huh.
And this was also going to be his very first tour.
Mm.
By that time, I had already toured with different people. So this, you know, so why not, you know, I'll go support that. And so I went down and I actually worked with him a little bit before it got to the point where they were going to audition. And he had gone to see a vocal coach that afternoon and tried to kind of tune up and get some things straight. We worked and then he went in. And he sang. So I waited outside, almost like a parent, like, oh, you know. He came out and he broke down and started crying. He hugged me. So they didn't give him the gig.
Oh, okay.
So I spent a lot of time just kind of trying to encourage him. Because my thing is not that he couldn't sing. I think it was just because of his inexperience. And I've had situations like that myself, right, where you know how to sing, but that doesn't mean that you know how to use your instrument the way it's required for that level of singing.
Right.
And I had to learn that. And I explained that to him too. I gave him some examples, but the whole thing was that they didn't give him the gig, and I haven't heard anything about him or since then. And I've asked people if they knew anything about him, and nobody seems to know.
Hmm.
But I'm just curious. My thing is, I hope that he didn't give up on singing. I hope that he, you know, if anything, it inspired him to maybe work more with that vocal coach he worked with that day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so hopefully he did that. But that's how I started working with PM Dawn. Tony Bridges was the one that set the whole wheel in motion for that.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, my name is Howard Cloud. Please watch In the Black of My Mind with host Al Thomas.
Any memorable moments on tour?
Yes.
Okay. Inquiring minds want to know.
Okay. Well, I have to really kind of filter some of these thoughts a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
Some of them.
I watch the R&B podcast. And they got a little segment on there where I ain't saying no names. So you could tell a story. It could be messed up. It could be funny, or it could be funny and messed up. But the rule is you can't say any names. And so of the stuff I hear these cats talk about is like.
Okay. All right. So there is. And I've been on tour with a few groups, so now you won't really be able to tell which one it is, unless you were there or involved. But we were performing in, I want to say it was upstate New York. And I was playing keyboards. And there was these girls that were in the front row. And you could tell that they were just having a good time. You know, they just, they might have worked together or something, and they came to the show. And so they just kept screaming. Anytime my name was called out, they screamed, they pointed at me, they jumped up and down. And so the principal, one of the principal performers, was actually performing a ballad, and they kept screaming. And because it was such a quiet song, you can hear them through his mic. Throughout the PA system.
Wow. Okay.
And we had broken the song down, and so you could really hear them, and they just wouldn't stop. And they kept saying, "What's his name? What's his name?" "Who, him? That's Robbie Jenkins." So they started screaming. Then the audience started screaming. Wow. I was embarrassed. I used to wear sunglasses on stage, because what would happen, not because the lights were bright or anything, but I noticed that if I looked in a certain direction, certain people screamed. So I figured if I had my sunglasses on, nobody could tell which way I'm looking unless I move my head. Mm-hmm. Well, what they did next was crazy, because there was a part where the song, the same song, had been broken down a little bit further, and one of the musicians was taking a solo. I'm not going to say any names. One of the girls was brave enough to have her friends hoist her up onto the stage. She ran over and just grabbed my left arm and just hugged it. Everybody's screaming and, you know, it's fun. It was fun up until a point. Up until a point where the sound, the stage monitor person, who was our sound guy, came out and grabbed her around the waist and was trying to pull her off of me. So now she's still holding onto my arm, and I'm still playing the chords to back up the other musician. And then it went from just my arm to these two fingers that she held with one hand. She had a gorilla grip. And so I felt my fingers being pulled out of socket, and I had to like wrench her a little bit to get her to let go.
Wow.
Moves her over and just drops her into the front row, and they're cheering, "Yay!" I met them after the show.
Oh, okay, okay.
Very, very nice ladies. They were just having fun. The other people on stage, well, one, the musician laughed about it. He said, "Here I am thinking they coming up to come to me, and they ran past me and went to yo." Right? the other person wasn't as lighthearted about it. Oh my God. Just some other things just came to mind. Can I tell one more story?
Go ahead, by all means.
Okay. I was on a different tour with a different group, and we were performing these very large venues. Actually, they were state parks. So you had like 120,000 people in one place, and maybe the shortest, I guess the smallest crowd was maybe like 90,000. You can see a lot of things from the stage, which is why I don't really particularly like to go to concerts now, because if you're in the audience, there's things you can't see that's coming in your direction, you know, like fights.
Right.
But in any case, so on this particular show, there's this guy, he's got a red baseball cap, a fitted, and it's turned back. He's got no shirt on, a pair of shorts, and he's stomping around. He's got beer and he's chugging with his friends. Yay! Right. So at one point I just kept watching him because he was kind of entertaining. And then I watched him. Not so the stage is like maybe close to 7 feet off the ground.
Oh, okay.
Right. So that people in the back can really see you. And then there's maybe about 3 feet, maybe 5 feet of space. And then there's a wall that's maybe 6 feet. Between the stage and the wall, that's where security was standing. Well, the audience is obviously on the other side of that wall. And so the guy with the red hat, he's stomping around. And then I see him walking into the crowd. It's almost like Moses was parting the Red Sea, because people were just moving and they stayed where they were. They didn't come back after he moved. They kept the path there. He got to a certain point, turned around, faced the stage, and ran full sprint towards the wall. I was like, is he going to run through the wall? No. What he did is he had two of his friends down there squatted with their hands cupped. He stepped in and they launched him in the air.
Oh, shoot.
He didn't have any boxers on. He's going towards the stage. I'm like, oh my God. I stopped playing. I'm looking now. And he hit this. He didn't quite make it all the way on the stage. So he landed. So if this is his stomach, edge of the stage. Boom.
Oh.
And then he got snatched off. Like he disappeared like he was never there. The security just snatched him. When we came off the stage, they had him covered in a sheet and strapped to a gurney.
You're going to take him to the hospital.
Yeah, there were people sitting on his leg so he couldn't move until the ambulance came down. And
wow.
He was under the influence of more than just alcohol.
Apparently. Yeah, I'm sure.
But it was a great gig. Lenny Kravitz was on that gig. Sinead O'Connor came on stage and was a guest background vocalist on one of her favorite songs that this particular act had. Mm. There was a lot of people. And Peter Gabriel, of course, because this was his tour.
Oh, okay.
The World of Music, Art, and Dance Tour, which was a global tour. Mm-hmm. And they did 6 dates in the United States. They were all in California, different state parks.
Nice.
I won't tell any more stories. Wait for the book to come out. Yeah.
I got some rapid fire questions. Who's your musical influences?
So,
who are your musical influences?
George Benson, Stevie Wonder.
Nice.
Earl Klug.
Nice.
Donny Hathaway.
I was waiting. I said, wait a minute. I know you got Donny in there somewhere.
Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah, no doubt. And that's the thing I'm sure, you know, so many people told you early on. Yeah, you sound like Stevie Wonder. You sound like Donny Hathaway.
Not that that's a bad thing.
I took it
as a compliment. Until I realized that if you sound so much like them, then what do you sound like?
Right.
And so I had to really work on that. And the only way I could was to not listen to any of their music for like cold turkey for a long time.
Mm.
And I've been a Stevie Wonder fan, according to my mother, since age 3. They actually took me to the Apollo. That was my first real. Yeah. So he was little Stevie Wonder then.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah, that's how I broke away from that, you know, from that whole label, you know, just really trying to find out who I was. It's just not listening to them, which was very harmful to my spirit. But I loved them. Yep.
Wow. What are your hobbies?
What are those? Let's see. I had some when I was younger. Like I used to I did martial arts. I skated. I played basketball. I was actually fairly good before I stopped. I wasn't when I started though. But that was pretty much it. I mean, most of the time that most people would have had hobbies, I was really focused on music.
Right.
So I didn't really have a lot of hobbies per se.
What would you consider to be your greatest accomplishment to date?
Meeting Mother Teresa.
Oh, wow.
My senior year in high school, Chamber Singers, we went over to Egypt and India, and I met her there. If you want, I can elaborate later on that so you could finish the rapid fire questions.
Well, you go ahead. You know, I mean,
okay. So part of the tour brought us to Calcutta, and we went to Prem Dom, which was the house of the destitute and the dying, where Mother Teresa and her sisterhood were taking care of people. They literally, if you don't know her story briefly, when she was sent as a missionary over to Calcutta, the first thing they noticed that people were dying in the street. And they didn't have any medical training, but they thought it would just be a decent human thing as to bring people off the street, bring them into a nice clean place, clean them up, and let them die in decency. And so when we got there, Prem Dom was set up into two separate sections. One was for adults, and the other one, surprisingly or sadly enough, were for children. So she brought us into the where the adults are, and we spread. She didn't say anything. She just opened the door and let us in, and we just walked in. We kind of gravitated to people. And, you know, sat on the bed and talked to them, held their hand. And then somebody started singing one of our songs. I wish I could remember the name of it. It was a really beautiful French piece. And because of the architecture, it sounded really like almost heavenly, right? People were crying. The people that we were singing to were smiling. And, and then we, you know, finished there and we went into the room where the children are. Now, children ranged in age from like maybe 17 to 2 months old.
Oh, wow.
Right. So these were the little ones were people that they, the little people they found in the arms of their parents who had already passed away in the street. Yeah.
Right.
So we sang to them. And when we came out, then Mother Teresa spoke to us. She thanked us because it wasn't planned that we were going to do that. We just went in and it just spontaneously happened. She said, I've seen smiles on faces that I never thought had smiles left. And the children that you sang to were moved too, I could tell. Like where they may have just been laying there, all of a sudden they had some spark of life. She said, so here's the part that I didn't tell you before you went in. The average life expectancy of the people that we bring through these doors is 4 days.
Wow.
It doesn't, regardless of age, because by the time we've gotten to them, they're pretty far advanced in, in whatever's going on with them. And so that means some of the younger people you met today and some of the adults 3 days from now will be gone. Yeah.
Wow. That's deep.
Very
deep, deep.
I could tell you when I came back from that tour, we were gone for the month of February. I could tell you that I thought I was already a pretty decent person. At least I tried to be. I still try to be. But in terms of just being a humane individual to other people, that experience, especially and specifically that, tuned it up a couple of notches. And it also made it very difficult for me to deal with some of the people I encountered back home. And I wasn't judging them, but I was just definitely noticing some things about them that shocked me. Some of them even recently have said and done some things that shocked me about it. It made me think twice about their character, where before I never thought about it at all. You know, these are people I just knew for a long period of time. And I think we want the best for most people that we know. So we have selection going on in our heads. We selectively see what we want and feel what we want about people. And then we excuse bad behavior. Well, it wasn't that bad. Or maybe they were just having a bad day. Or they probably didn't really mean that. They meant it. It's just that it's your unwillingness to accept that that's who they really are. So I've adapted. I know this is going a little bit further than what you asked me, but what I have learned to do in the last 3 or 4 years is allow people to be who they are so I could see who they are. And then once I am aware of what that is or who that version is, then I make the determination whether I want to continue to be involved with who they are. There's no point in having a confrontation. I just make a decision and I move with it.
Oh, no doubt. Yeah. Well, Sister Maya said when someone shows you who they are, believe them the first time.
That's right.
So that's deep. What's on your bucket list?
Ooh. Well, I could tell you what used to be on there.
What's that?
Mountain climbing. And then.
Really?
Yeah. I wanted to mountain climb. Skydiving.
You said used to. You don't want to do it anymore? Oh, okay.
No. I feel very fortunate to have lived as long as I have.
Exactly.
Why take chances?
Yeah. No.
Right?
No.
I wanted, you know, a couple of decades ago, I was going to go skydiving with a coworker. Uh-huh. The first time we had scheduled it, it rained, so they didn't go up. Uh-huh. The second time, she ended up having a medical emergency, and which led to the third time that she got the results back, and she was pregnant.
Oh, okay.
So I said, I'm not supposed to go up
and
jump off of a perfectly working plane.
No, not at all.
So I'm not going to do that.
When I was in the military, when I finished basic training, they were trying to get us to go to jump school. And they said, if you go to jump school, and they'll pay you an extra $50 a month.
Not a whole $50.
$50 a month, bro. I was like, man, there's no way. I'm not jumping out of a perfectly good airplane.
Right.
The only reason if I'm jumping is because there's no chance of this plane landing.
Right.
That's the only time. I got to have two parachutes.
Right.
You know, otherwise, well, you know what? Maybe we can ride this out, man. Just... Go that way. Don't go down. Go that way.
And glide it out.
You know what I'm saying? See that water over there? You know, just glide along
right
the water,
there.
Man. We can swim.
I can swim.
Man, please.
Yep.
What skill would you most like to learn?
Ooh. How to cook better.
Really?
I'm tired of eating sugar frosted flakes. I mean, I like it.
Uh-huh. But.
But. I want to do something. I could cook enough to survive.
Right.
I'm just not in the kitchen. That I don't really, you know, I guess if I had to and I have more time, mm-hmm. Then I would, you know, if that's the only way I was going to eat. But currently my situation isn't, you know, that I'm blessed to still have my mom with me. So that's her kitchen.
Right.
And you find that out if you put something back in the wrong place. Where is the spoon with the holes in it?
Right. Okay.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Not me.
Right?
Not me put it somewhere. I didn't do that. So cooking is one. I'd like to actually learn how to cook more.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Where is the coolest place you ever traveled to?
Ooh. Wow, that's tough. That's tough. I could tell you that I wanted to move to London when I was graduating from high school. So when I got a chance to actually go there in high school, I still wanted to move there.
Okay.
And then when I went over there with PM Dawn, no offense to anybody, but at that time, it was just really too risky. There was a lot of political things going on. Mm. And while we were there, we came back from the television. We went over to actually to film a tape a television show called Zoo TV. It's kind of similar to like a cross between like David Letterman and Johnny Carson at that time. So
we
had the little skits and stuff. So we did those. We did that show. We got back to the hotel. We were still hungry. And we were going to go walk to go get something to eat. And then we found out what had happened the earlier part of the day when we were leaving. There was a bunch of fire engines and stuff going down the street. Well, one of the political, I guess you would call political adversaries or what have you, right? They had called in a bomb threat at the McDonald's down the street. So they cordoned off everything a couple of blocks back away from there. And while they were there, a bomb went off in a mailbox right where everybody was standing.
Oh, wow.
And it was a small bomb, so not too many people got hurt. Nobody was killed, but there was definitely a bomb. And then the message got called back in because this organization apparently had been dormant for quite some time, and people, I guess, thought that they were not still active, and that was their way of letting you know we're still here, and so we haven't gone anywhere. And I said, I don't want to be in McDonald's eating a French fry,
right?
Blown across the street to Kentucky Fried Chicken. I would have just walked over there if that's what
right, right. If that's what I wanted to do. Yeah.
So,
wow.
So that was a little scary. I don't think they have a lot of that going on right now. But other than that, I really love London. I love the vibe. You know, especially if you're a musician, you know, just being in Europe and playing. They are really. They're really into music to the point of they're into music and not trends as much.
Gotcha.
Right. So you could put out, if once they're a fan, they're a fan. You could put out, Al Thomas Jr. can put out an album of nursery rhymes. And if it's you and they're a fan of yours, they're going to buy it.
Mm.
Right. Mm. They're going to come see you perform it. Yeah, they really come out. More so here than in the States, you know, if they're a fan of yours, they're a fan of yours right now. If you get too quiet for too long, they almost forget that you existed because they've already moved on to the next trend or the next new artist or whatever. So that's a little bit more. This is why a lot of musicians leave here and go overseas.
Right.
Right. Right, they tour over there. To some of the people we haven't heard about in a long time, they're still active,
right?
And some of them even moved,
exactly.
So they could still continue to work. I like living here, even though at one point I wanted to, you know, move and live in London. Mm-hmm. So maybe when I make some Al Thomas money, I will I'll have dual residency. I live sometimes here, and then sometimes
Stanford
across the pond
and West in the Haven. UK.
So I'm still making that, I'm still, you know, working on making that A Thomas money,
man. A Thomas is trying to make some A Thomas money. Man, what is the most important decision you've made to date?
Recently I made a very important decision. So my company, Overture Entertainment Incorporated, which until I made this decision, I didn't even realize that I've had that company for 30 years. Mm. Actually, a little longer than that, but I incorporated in February of 1995.
Gotcha.
And so the thing about it is I started it as an S corporation as opposed to an LLC, because at that point, the music industry was primarily and predominantly run by S corps. Right. Mm-hmm. So you had Inc. at the end, you know, mm-hmm. and I, you know, so all these major labels, they were S corporations. They were not LLCs. And my thing was that I was starting from a very good vantage point. 2 years before I incorporated, the company existed, but primarily just to monitor my career activities, to hire me out to do recording sessions with artists and to do tours and things like that.
Right.
So,
and for tax purposes.
And for tax purposes, right? Mm. So the seed money I needed, I was making.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that was easy. I also didn't have the overhead that some of the other companies had. I didn't have a 10-story building with 500 employees in and out the front door.
Right. Right?
It was myself and a very small team of people. And so the whole thing was, it was kind of easy to kind of build. And for the first 10 years, I know that we were making a small profit and rising, but the industry was changing, right? So the way that most major labels or all of them were making money, the industry was changing and moving away from that business model.
Right.
So if you had an S corporation, especially if you had one like they did, they were fighting and clawing to stay afloat. You know, so some closed. Some actually merged with former competitors to form joint ventures so that they could still function together. And even with that, if one company has a president and this one has a president, which one is staying as the president? You know, so you can have two presidents for one company.
Right.
So there was a lot of restructuring going on. I'm watching this and I'm saying, oh, but I'm doing okay, right? And so the line of profit and loss was here, and I was some years I was here and some years I was here, and then that curve started to broaden on this side,
not so much on this side.
So sometimes I would break even or not, but I wasn't making any more of a profit. And then there were some other business ventures that came up where I decided, well, let's see how this goes, because this could turn things around.
Right.
Wasn't timely enough. And if you've ever had and anybody out there who's in a different industry or even in this one, it costs a lot to have a corporation, an S corporation, especially the taxes, the fees you have to pay, that there's mm-hmm. just so much. And so I wasn't seeing a return on my investment.
Gotcha.
Which means that in essence, this had all now dwindled to, or not dwindled, but shifted to an LLC environment. That's the new landscape of the music industry, right? LLCs, which are so much easier and so much more affordable. Mm-hmm. So I made the decision to dissolve my company. And I did that like 10 days after my 30th anniversary. That's when I realized it had been 30 years. Cause I was just going from year to year and just grinding and doing stuff and working with people and just, you know, creating. So I really wasn't paying attention to the clock as much.
Right.
Or the calendar. But yeah, I dissolved the company February 26th of 2025, this year. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just kind of doing some last minute things to just kind of wind that down. And then I'm going to take a mental break. I'm not rushing back into my next whatever, mm-hmm. But there will be a next.
Right.
But it will not be an S corporation. I can assure you of that.
Right.
Yeah, it was tough.
Oh, I'm sure, because that was your baby.
Yeah. But the funny thing about it is that it wasn't depressing, only because the last 4 or 5 years I had already kind of seen that it was heading in that direction.
Right.
And then started mentally preparing myself to do it. Some other things came up that, like I said earlier, could possibly turn it around. I just wanted to wait it out and see. It did not. It did not do that. Yeah.
All right. Switching things up a little bit. What's your favorite song?
Of my own or of
no, people? No, not your own. That's like your children, man. You can't.
Yeah, I don't have children. that depends on the day. I don't really know if I have a favorite song. I have artists that I obviously I mentioned earlier that I admire and that I've looked up to and liked, and so I like all their catalog, and they have. You know, if you're talking about Stevie, I'm not even going to try to count how many songs he has. Right?
Exactly.
So I just like music. Right. And so depending on the day, certain songs just hit me. Right. And I might find myself humming it. And I was like, well, why am I humming that song today?
Right.
It can't be connected to anything other than it just was in my spirit that particular day.
Okay. So who's your favorite group?
I don't know.
Who's your favorite artist?
Well, Stevie Wonder is my favorite artist.
Okay.
He's my, and mainly because of all that he does, right? In terms of writing and producing, his musicianship is just otherworldly. And his productions are always something. Like you went to go see a show that I wish I had caught when he was traveling with the orchestra.
Yeah.
I didn't even know that was happening.
That was so awesome.
Yep.
But the show you and I went to together up in Hartford and stuff, that was the first time I saw him. And I'll never forget, we're sitting there going, oh, yo, that's my song. And then something else, no, this
that's
is
my song.
Yeah. And did that all night long.
The whole
stuff,
show
man.
Was my song.
Yeah.
I could and you just brought to mind something else in the same venue, because that was the Hartford Civic Center. Earth, Wind & Fire came there.
That's where I saw it the first time too.
All
you
I
know what
say,
year it was? You remember?
Yes. 1981,
81, okay. 82,
yeah.
Okay.
That was the Let's Groove Tonight tour.
Gotcha.
I could say this, sold out crowd. They just blew everybody out of the water. When it was done, you have maybe 8,000 to 10,000 people in dead silence.
I was going to say the same thing. That's what I experienced.
People were walking, but I don't even think they remembered where they were.
Wow.
Did I drive here or did somebody drop me off? And as we filtered out of the venue into the lobby and going out to the street, again, dead silence. Nobody spoke.
Yeah.
I can't even describe that because I didn't say anything either.
Yeah, exactly.
And inside, I wanted to say, did you see that? Did you remember this? None of that was coming out. My mouth didn't even move like it was going to say anything.
Yeah. I saw them in 77. Mm. My sister Wandy took me to the concert. And the opening act was the Jones Girls. And then the middle act was Denise Williams. And then Earth, Wind & Fire. So, I mean, I was already blown away after the Jones Girls. And then when Denise Williams did Free, I lost it again. And then Earth. And, man, they just, oh, my. And they had all the original players there then. So, you know, oh, man, I was so messed up. this last question I got is, might be the most difficult of all of them. Tell me your life story. In one sentence.
Ooh. How do you come up with this stuff?
Oh, man, you know, I'm trying to put everybody in the torture chamber.
My life story in one sentence. Early struggles. I've had early struggles that helped to sharpen the steel that I've become.
All right. I like that. I like that. How can people contact you on social media?
Okay. So I'm on Instagram and Facebook and LinkedIn actually. So it's, if it's Facebook, Facebook is facebook.com/Robbie Jenkins Music. Same thing for Instagram, instagram.com/Robbie Jenkins Music. And the same thing for LinkedIn, linkedin.com/Robbie Jenkins Music.
Gotcha. No, bro, I appreciate you greatly, man, for doing this, man.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. I was just waiting my turn, hoping that I would get a turn.
No, man, please. This has been another episode of In the Black of My Mind podcast. Make sure you like, comment, subscribe, and share. Until next week, y'all be blessed.